The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next hour I will be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com. That is gsuggsinsurance.com, or call 919-875-8889. Today's edition of Time Magazine is dated September 12/September 19, 2022. As usual, it is bordered in red with a narrow inner border of white. The background today is gray with Time in large block lettering and capital letters superimposed in a lighter gray upon that background. In the foreground is a profile of a woman of color. Hair is pulled back very tightly into a curly ponytail. There's an earring on the right ear. It says M-A, Ma. Eyes are closed, mouth is closed. The head is tilting upward. Again, it is in profile. The subtitle beneath Time is the greatest, and it is, according to an inside description, Serena Williams. Beginning with For the Record. $850,000 sale price of a Ford Escort that had been customized for Princess Diana to drive on errands around London at auction August 27. She truly is an icon, spoken by Elton John about Britney Spears following their collaboration on the single Hold Me Closer, released August 26. $310,605, the average cost of raising a second child born in 2015 to age 17 for a middle-income U.S. couple with two children, per a Brookings Institute estimate, reported by the Wall Street Journal, August 17. Why so much anger at women? Simone Tebet said, the Brazilian senator, responding at an August 28 presidential debate to incumbent Jair Bolsonaro's sexist lashing out at a female journalist. I am human, and amid these dark times, I too miss joy, light, and fun, said Sanna Marin, Finland's prime minister, responding to criticism over images of her partying with friends. There literally will be riots in the streets, said Lindsey Graham, Republican senator, predicting what would happen if former President Donald Trump is indicted for mishandling classified documents, August 28 on Fox News. Why doesn't the rest of the world need this extra minute? Attributed to Du Sir, a Chinese film blog on a one-minute epilogue about morals that censors there added to the film Minions, The Rise of Gru. The brief Lone War Looms by Brian Bennett. Conservative groups are intent on challenging Biden's student debt plan to find the authority to cancel billions of dollars in student loans. President Biden turned to two words in a 2003 law, national emergency. President George W. Bush had troops in Afghanistan and Iraq when Congress passed the Higher Education Relief Opportunities for Students Act of 2003. The bill gives the Secretary of Education authority to change student financial assistance programs during a war, military operation, or national emergency. 19 years later, the Biden administration cited that law in announcing a plan to forgive up to $10,000 of student loan debt and $20,000 of education debt for Pell Grant recipients. For those earning less than $125,000, the national emergency it cited was the COVID-19 pandemic and economic fallout stemming from it. That reasoning is almost certain to be challenged in court, but who can legally challenge the order is unclear. As soon as Biden announced his order, various conservative legal groups began exploring who would have legal standing to sue, which would require proving they were harmed by Biden's order. One possibility, the House could sue over the order next year if Republicans win enough seats to take control in the fall. It's on a shaky legal ground at best, says Lene Erickson, Senior Vice President for Social Policy, Education, and Politics at Third Way, a Washington think tank that looks for nonpartisan policy solutions. Erickson's concern that Biden's action overreaches in its reliance on the national emergency of the pandemic, and that the courts will determine such a step requires congressional action. The connection to the pandemic is pretty exaggerated, I think. Biden's order followed his promise on the campaign trail to take action to help some of the 44 million Americans with a collective $1.7 trillion in education debt hanging over their heads. Last year, Biden himself said he was not sure he could use executive action alone to forgive a large tranche of student debt, like $50,000 per borrower. "I don't think I have the authority to do it by signing with a pen," he said in February 2021. But since he announced the loan debt forgiveness actions, the administration has rejected doubts about his authority to act. The federal government temporarily suspended student loan payments early on in the pandemic. That suspension is set to end December 31. The loan forgiveness plan is targeted to go into effect the next day. Part of what the legal authority is being used to do here in a targeted way is to make sure those borrowers who are at highest risk of distress after the restart happens, those are the people who are going to get the relief, says Bharat Ramamurthy, the deputy director of Biden's National Economic Council. Since Biden announced the order August 24, legal groups and experts have speculated on who might have standing to challenge it. Companies that service the student loans may attempt to prove they've been harmed. A person who makes an income just over the $125,000 threshold for forgiveness could potentially claim to have standing. Or one of the chambers of Congress could try to take the Biden administration to court, arguing Biden's loan action steps on congressional power over the nation's finances. But such a move could only happen if Republicans won enough seats to take control of the House or Senate. Such a suit would not be unprecedented. In 2014, the Republican-controlled House voted to sue the Obama administration over its application of the Affordable Care Act. Though House Republicans were ultimately granted standing to sue, that lawsuit ended up having little effect on the implementation of the law. In 2019, House Democrats sued the Trump administration over its spending on building a border wall. If Republicans take back control of the House, Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy is the front runner to be the next Speaker. McCarthy's office would not comment on whether House Republicans would sue the Biden administration over the student loan action if they gained control of the chamber. I would expect there would be challenges. This is such a slap in the face to everybody who did what they were supposed to do, says Reed Rubenstein, Director of Oversight and Investigations for the America First Legal Foundation, which was founded by Stephen Miller, a former senior advisor to former President Donald Trump. Rubenstein says it is too early to know if his organization, which has challenged multiple Biden administration policies, would get involved in challenging the loan forgiveness. He did think Congress would have standing to bring a case to protect its institutional interests over the power of the purse. The Job Creators Network Foundation Legal Action Fund, which successfully sued the Biden administration in 2021 over vaccine mandates on behalf of small business owners, is actively weighing its legal options, says President and CEO Alfredo Ortiz in a statement. From the news ticker, three short items here. Omicron booster set for release. The first Omicron variant-specific COVID-19 vaccine booster shots are on track to become available to the public in mid-September, according to the White House. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration, FDA, authorized shots from Moderna and Pfizer-BioNTech August 31. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC, was expected to give its okay September 1. Black History gets its first AP class. 60 high schools nationwide launched the first Advanced Placement AP African American Studies course this fall in a pilot program. It marks the first new AP class since 2014, and next year students will be eligible to earn college credit at certain universities. Jackson, Mississippi water system in crisis. The 150,000 residents of Jackson, Mississippi will have little or no access to tap water, not even to flush toilets or fight fires for the foreseeable future, the governor warned August 30. The water outage followed the failure of pumps at the city's main water treatment plant. Epic flooding. I will read the caption of this photo. It's dismal. There are mountains in the background. Perched along the hillsides are many buildings with various colors of roofs and facades. It's green all over except a very wide, muddy, angry-looking, roaring river in the middle ground. It's cresting. It's at least up to its level of its banks, if not overflowing, because in the foreground there are many people, mostly robed in fabric, with the women wearing the fabric over their heads and draped around their shoulders. It appears that several men are running through a muddy bog. People gather in front of a road washed out by unprecedented flooding in Pakistan's northern Swat Valley, August 27. The country's climate minister described the devastation, which has killed more than 1,130 people since mid-June, as a climate-induced humanitarian disaster of epic proportions. The floods have pushed almost 500,000 people into relief camps. Scientists point out that Pakistan, a poorer country that has contributed comparatively little in carbon emissions, is feeling disproportionate effects of the climate crisis. The bulletin, Ukraine aid package, shows U.S. is in it for the long haul, by W.J. Hennigan. The $3 billion military aid package for Ukraine, announced by President Biden August 24, revealed his administration expects the war with Russia to last for many months or years, and signaled that Washington is in the fight for the duration. The package marks the largest slice of the $13.7 billion in U.S. military aid provided to date and includes weaponry that will not appear on the battlefield for a year or more. The prospective shipments of sophisticated American-made weaponry well into the future, in contrast with previous tranches designed to help with ongoing battles or imminent counteroffensives, are intended to show Western allies, Ukraine, and Russia, the U.S. means to stick with the war regardless of daily gains or losses. The United States of America is committed to supporting the people of Ukraine as they continue the fight to defend their sovereignty, Biden said. The aid, which came on the 31st anniversary of Ukrainian independence from the Soviet Union, promises 245,000 rounds of 155-millimeter artillery ammunition, surface-to-air missile systems, and laser-guided rocket systems. While previous weapons were drawn from existing U.S. stockpiles to expedite delivery, many of these items have yet to be manufactured and could take as long as 2 years to reach the battlefield. The new aid also includes funding for U.S. troops to continue providing weapons training to the Ukrainian military elsewhere in Europe for several years. The administration has repeatedly insisted U.S. troops will not fight in Ukraine, but Biden has sent thousands of forces into surrounding countries to deliver on-the-ground guidance to Ukraine and reassurance to allies. Colin Call, Undersecretary of Defense for Policy, said Russian President Vladimir Putin is wrong to believe Russia can win the long game, outlasting the Ukrainians in their will to fight and the international community's will to continue its support. More news tickers here. Resignation sparks Iraq violence. At least 23 people were killed in clashes in Iraq's capital, Baghdad, August 29, after a powerful Shiite cleric, Muqtada al-Sadr, announced he was quitting politics. Tensions have soared in the country since inconclusive elections in October left Sadr's bloc unable to form a government with Iran-backed parties. Singapore divided on LGBTQ rights. Prime Minister Lee Hsien Loong announced August 21 Singapore would decriminalize gay sex, but enshrine its ban on same-sex marriage in the Constitution. As the city-state joins other Asian governments caught between conservative electorates and growing LGBTQ rights movements. Greenland, zombie ice to raise sea levels. The rapid melt of ice in Greenland that is no longer being replenished by glaciers will cause more than 10 inches of global sea level rise, possibly by the end of the century, according to a study published August 29. The impact of that zombie ice would be more than twice the amount forecast by last year's IPCC report. Trump's trove of classified files, there's a photo here of what appears to be a floor. It looks like carpeting, dark, possibly brown or black, with large figurative designs in it in various shades of brown and cream. Kind of a floral motif, not quite paisley, not quite floral. And on top of the carpeting is a stack of strewn documents. This particular pile is labeled 2A. This photo of files seized from former President Donald Trump's residence at Mar-a-Lago in Florida, released August 30 by the Justice Department, DOJ, shows at least five yellow cover sheets marked Top Secret and a red cover page marked Secret. The picture was part of a 36-page court filing alleging the DOJ had received information classified documents were being concealed from investigators. The August 8 FBI search recovered more than 100 classified documents taken from the White House. Trump has claimed without evidence that he declassified the files before leaving office. Good question. How are companies reacting to the quiet quitting trend? This is by Mariah Espada. Maggie Perkins had been working as a teacher in Georgia for nearly 5 years before she decided to quiet quit her job. The decision did not mean leaving her position, but rather limiting her work to her contract hours. Nothing more, nothing less. If I did not quiet quit my teaching job, I would burn out, she says. Perkins joins a larger online community of workers who've been sharing their experiences on TikTok, but as quiet quitters defend their choice to take a step back from work, company executives and workplace experts argue that although doing less might feel good in the short term, it could harm your career and your company in the long run. In the wake of the global pandemic and the subsequent Great Resignation, employees began to reimagine what work could look like. Gallup's State of the Global Workplace report in June found job dissatisfaction at an all-time high, with 60% reporting emotional detachment from work. Disengaged workers cost the global economy an estimated $7.8 trillion in lost productivity. But with worries of an economic slowdown, swirling, and falling worker productivity, Johnny C. Taylor, Jr., president and CEO of Society for Human Resource Management, warns that anyone who tells their business leader they are a quiet quitter is likely not to have a job for very long. He says companies have become sensitive to worker burnout, especially with employees who are working from home. Gare Govari, CEO of job board platform Lensa, advocates an alternative to quiet quitting, loudly persisting. That is, empowering employees to speak up about how their organization can serve their goals. When you loudly persist, you have a sense of belonging and of having a stake in where the company's going, he says. Career coach Allison Peck says she views quiet quitting as a symptom of employees not connecting to their work or managers. Her career advice for quiet quitters is to take even bolder action, finding a new job, manager, team, or company that better aligns with you can improve your mindset at work, she says. Some workers, though, say companies' concerns about quiet quitting are unfounded. Shini Ko, a software developer, says she's not convinced quiet quitting is the best term for simply setting boundaries at work. She has set limits on her hours and now runs a small-scale vegetable farm in her spare time. It is negative and dangerous that we frame a healthy work-life balance as quitting, says Ko. Can we just call it what it is? It is just working. Milestones. Infected. North Korean leader Kim Jong-un with COVID-19 despite declaring victory over the pandemic, state-run media announced August 30. Died, the first U.S. patient from a known case of monkeypox, Texas health officials reported August 30. Spilled more than 150,000 tomatoes onto a California highway August 29 after a big rig crashed into another vehicle and hit the median. Sold, a Mickey Mantle baseball card for $12.6 million August 28, making it the most valuable piece of sports memorabilia ever sold at auction. Fired Uvalde, Texas school police chief Pete Arredondo, August 24, by the school board after criticism he mishandled the response to the mass shooting at Robb Elementary, where 19 children and two teachers were killed. Announced Taylor Swift's new album, Midnights, which is set for release in October at the MTV VMAs, August 28. Died the last member of a Brazilian indigenous tribe that had no contact with the outside world, the country's government confirmed August 27. He had lived alone since 1995, when the other members of his tribe were killed. Also died, this is a longer item, Mikhail Gorbachev, creator of A New World by Bono, who's lead singer of U2. This piece is adapted from Surrender, 40 Songs, One Story, to be released November 1 from Knopf. In my lifetime, no one person has had the impact on the world that Mikhail Gorbachev, who died August 30 at 91, did. Though Vladimir Putin would attempt to pull down the digital blinds, the rolling back of the Iron Curtain is right next to Neil Armstrong's Walking on the Moon, as the most awe-inspiring events I have witnessed on a television. But unlike the moon, the world Mikhail Gorbachev landed on was one I walked on myself. Two epoch-making events, one signaling human ambition to challenge the boundaries of where we might live, the other redrawing the boundaries of where we actually do live. For a quarter century, my wife Ollie has worked with an Irish NGO, Chernobyl Children International. Along with other Irish volunteers, Ollie has made regular journeys to the region. On one such trip, she met Anna, one of several thousand children brought to Ireland for surgical procedures. Anna was adopted by a family in Cork, and she became Ali's goddaughter. And as the universe would have it, Anna was staying with us when one weekend in 2002, Gorbachev dropped by. Anna had been born with severe physical disabilities due to the radiation poisoning of her parents following the nuclear accident at Chernobyl. As she entered the room in which the great man sat, we sensed the poignancy of this unexpected meeting. Gorbachev's voice quieted to a murmur as he explained that it was that 1986 nuclear disaster at Chernobyl that convinced him the Soviet Union could not continue as it was. I thought to myself, if the state cannot control a nuclear power plant of this significance, then the state is no longer functioning as a state. The state is kaput. When we see the devastation that splitting an atom can cause, then this is untenable. This cannot ever be acceptable. The Soviet Union was no longer viable. It has to find a new path, a path that must include rapprochement with the West. So this had been a moment when Mikhail Gorbachev changed his own history and ours. We discover history that does not have to shape us. The world is more malleable than we imagine, and things do not have to be the way they are. History is clay and can be pummeled or punched, corralled or even caressed into a whole new shape. Culture is Boys Love the New K-Pop by Chad de Guzman, Bangkok. Forget Korean soaps. The hottest shows in many parts of the world are queer romances known as Boys Love, BL. BL began as graphic novels in Japan before making it to the small screen in Thailand. The genre took off during the COVID-19 pandemic, when millions in Asia and Latin America, bored at home, embraced what Thomas Baudinet of Sydney's Macquarie University calls the emancipatory, very positively framed depictions of male-male love. Insiders hope the genre can do for Thailand what K-pop did for South Korea. Actor Chitarafal Potiwiok says BL storylines rival series from other countries, but the road ahead isn't smooth. The Thai government helped secure $10.7 million in foreign investments for BL productions in 2021, but the sum is paltry in Hollywood terms, and many in the military-backed regime are likely unhappy with even this level of support. BL creators know to tread carefully. The shows never get too racy and avoid depicting discrimination faced by LGBT ties. For producers like Nutapong Mongkolsawas, it's an acceptable trade-off. Only by becoming commercially successful, he says, can BL show that nothing is wrong with queer love. Under the heading Climate, A Missed Chance on the Colorado River by Alejandro de la Garza. A photo here, not very large, but in color. Deep blue skies in the background, in front of which are sandy-colored hills, a blue lake or pond, and in front of that, more sandy-colored-looking dirt. There's something in the pond. There are two things. Something is afloat in the background with a person standing on the craft, wearing probably a green life jacket. But in front of that, it appears to be almost an obelisk. It is a sunken boat that's upturned, and it's revealed as Lake Mead plummets to record low levels in June. So this is Lake Mead, and it really looks like a little old fishing hole. There is something familiar about the high-stakes water use drama playing out in the parched U.S. Southwest. The mighty Colorado River serves as an economic artery of the region, powering massive hydroelectric dams and supplying water to farmers and rapidly growing cities. But continued overuse during a massive years-long megadrought, the driest stretch the area has experienced in more than a millennium, has caused reservoir levels to fall to unprecedented lows, imperiling water supplies and the operation of crucial power plants. Seven states rely on water from the Colorado River: Colorado, Wyoming, Utah, New Mexico, Arizona, California, and Nevada. In June, the federal government told them they had 60 days to come up with a plan to massively scale back their consumption. That deadline came and went in August with no agreement. And though the federal government did announce a new round of water cuts mandated in a previous drought plan, 21% for Arizona, 8% for Nevada, 7% for Mexico, which also relies on the river, it did not follow through on its threat to impose more severe water cuts in the absence of state action. This means reservoir levels will continue to fall, risking severe electricity and water shortages across the region. The drought is no fluke. Human-caused climate change is a significant part of the problem, with higher temperatures causing more runoff from rain and snow to evaporate before it reaches the Colorado River. State governments, meanwhile, are fighting among themselves, each trying to protect the water rights crucial for agriculture and expanding housing development. In theory, federal threats should force water use cuts. States would rather hash out a deal themselves and let Washington decide who gets what share of the river. But that works only if the Biden administration is willing to anger Southwest voters. A hard pill for Democrats to swallow heading into tough midterm elections. That is not so different from the international climate situation, where despite lofty promises, many countries are still delaying much of the difficult, urgently needed action to cut emissions and stave off disaster. In both cases, leaders are playing a game of chicken, holding out on hard decisions and hoping most of the costs will fall elsewhere, all while the actual problems get worse for everyone. But the bitter bargaining over who makes what sacrifices is likely to play out on a radically shorter time scale along the Colorado River. What the region's authorities do give us an idea of how the global climate fight will play out among the world's biggest polluters. Whether international leaders will take action before the worst crises begin or wait to see what new escalating peril will make the tough decisions for them. Movies, two reviews here by Stephanie Zakarik, both of them. A wily, wicked church satire. Again, these are movies. There is a devilish, damnation-worthy idea at the heart of Honk for Jesus, Save Your Soul. Writer-director Adama Ebo's satire about the pastor and first lady of a Southern Baptist megachurch who scramble to reclaim their past glory after a scandal sends their congregation scattering. That staggeringly charismatic pastor, Lee Curtis Childs, Sterling K. Brown, is the source of all the trouble, having instigated more than one illicit affair. His dutiful wife, Trinity, Regina Hall, is left to clean up most of the mess, standing by her husband's side, even as he peacocks around in his costly suits, readying himself for his public redemption. Ebo mines a lot of territory here, especially the hypocrisy of black churches that preach love for all human beings, as long as they are not gay. She is also attuned to the reality of women who work overtime to make their weak husbands look good. There's almost too much going on in Honk for Jesus. The film jumps a bit randomly from one thematic thread to another. Still, the actors hold this story together. Hall has some terrific moments. At one point, Trinity proudly shows Lee Curtis the expensive Space Age-style hat she intends to wear on Comeback Sunday. When he cuts her down, the disappointment on her face, edged with anger, is a galaxy of feeling, compressed into a few seconds. In life, if not always in church, God is in the details. A loner academic, an unbottled gin, and lots of talking, again by Stephanie Zakarik. In the world of romantic desire, there is no such thing as close enough for jazz. You either hit the note or you don't. George Miller's 3,000 Years of Longing, adapted from an A.S. Byatt short story, strives for something romantic and magical and almost reaches those heights, but a movie starring Tilda Swinton and Idris Elba as, respectively, a gloriously mousy academic who tells stories about stories and a seductive, wish-granting djinn, that's D-J-I-N-N, should provide at least a smidgen of unintellectualized eroticism. Yet the arrow 3,000 Years of Longing shoots from its mighty bow, just does not pierce as it should. What it does offer is plenty of talking. Swinton's Alethea Binney is a self-described loner, happy with her own company, but perhaps she secretly longs for something more. On a business trip to Istanbul, she buys a strange, stripy glass bottle, which breaks as she scrubs it in her hotel sink. From it emerges Elba's muscular, beguiling djinn, a supernatural hottie with pointed ears, shimmering skin, and a sonorous voice. In exchange for his freedom, he's ready to grant Alethea three wishes. What ensues is a heady, if circuitous, conversation between these two about the nature of love and companionship. It is all quite sweet and cerebral, and some of the effects are fanciful. When the djinn tells the story of how Solomon seduced the beyond beautiful Sheba, we see the king playing a lute-type instrument that becomes a living thing in his hands, complete with a small mouth warbling sweet nothings from somewhere near the tuning pegs. But movies about smart people being smart together aren't as romantic as you might think. Alethea and her djinn represent a meeting of minds, maybe of souls, across time and space. Is it too much to ask for a little more electricity between them? Just some nominal acknowledgement of the role of our desire in our lives? It is true that stories, some handed down through centuries, can offer us pleasure and sustenance. Still, 3,000 years is a long time to wait for a good cuddle. From 8 questions here, Dr. Rochelle Walensky, the director of the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, is trying to change the agency to fix its dramatic mistakes during COVID-19. This article will be in question-answer format. The writer is Alice Park. There's a photograph in black and white of Dr. Walensky at the bottom of the page. It's not very large. It shows a smiling woman with not quite shoulder-length dark hair, combed back somewhat. She has dark eyes and dark eyebrows and sparkly earrings. It looks like she's wearing lip color. The lips look darker than the rest of her face. She's wearing a white shirt with a delicate necklace around her neck. What, in your view, are the biggest ways in which the CDC has to change? Answer. I don't think that moving boxes around on an organizational chart alone will fix the problem. What we are talking about is a culture change. Reorganization is hard, but I think this is even harder than that. Question. You requested an in-depth review of the CDC's operations and just received the report. What prompted you to conduct that review? Answer. In its 76-year history, the CDC has always been preparing for a pandemic, but never really had to manage one. It was an interesting time to look back and say, how did things go? We needed to put a mirror up to our own agency and see the challenges we faced within. The senior leaders cast a wide net and did more than 170 interviews with staff, intergovernmental officials, prior CDC directors, and people in academia and public health departments. Question, what did those interviews reveal about where the CDC fell short? Answer, this agency has been developed on an infrastructure of academia, one that is publication-driven, one that generally talks to scientists, public health experts, and academics. We learned we are no longer simply an agency for public health officials. We have to be an agency for the American people. Question. The CDC has been criticized for issuing confusing advice about masks, among other things. Was that a failure in communicating the science to the public? Answer. We all did not like the headlines, especially when we knew all of the good work that was going on. So how do we address the challenge of what people are saying about us? We found ourselves having to convey the nuances of the reasons behind the decisions we made with science that was difficult to convey. But we did not have to convince the scientific audience. We had to convince the American people. The latest CDC guidance that we have rolled out is much more readable, much more accessible, and not tied down by the minutiae of scientific technicalities. Question. One issue the review raised was the lengthy process of collecting, processing, and sharing data. How will the CDC do this more efficiently? Answer. We have to get our data out faster. We're talking about how we can post data earlier, whether by putting it on a preprint server before it's vetted by independent experts, or by publishing a technical report before it's officially published, so people can see the data driving the agency's decisions. Question, what does changing the culture of the CDC entail? Answer, the single most important question that everyone should be asking is, will this address a public health need? We really need to talk about public health action and not just public health publication. Question. Some have said the CDC's handling of monkeypox testing was too slow. Is that fair? Answer. We had a test for monkeypox where we did not have one for SARS-CoV-2 initially. We knew about monkeypox infection, and we published online how one would do the test. Within the first week of the first case, we were reaching out to commercial labs to expand testing quickly. Question, can the public expect to see changes in the way the CDC communicates about monkeypox? Answer, I think it will be a gradual shift. People will not wake up after Labor Day and think, everything's different. Culture change involves hard work, and it will take some time. Americans might not notice, but there have already been tangible changes at the agency. Time off calendar. This is the fall culture preview. I'm reading only a section of it today. It's been compiled by Shannon Carlin, Angela Haupt, Katie Lang, Moises Mendez II, and Laura Zornosa. These are the movies, TV shows, albums, and books we will be talking about all season. It looks like this page pertains to movies. Oh, no, it's a mixture. I'll read each caption when it arises. September 2, movie, Honk for Jesus, Save Your Soul. Regina Hall is the wife of this disgraced Southern Baptist pastor, Sterling K. Brown, whose attempted comeback forces her to reevaluate her faith and marriage. September 2, TV, The Rings of Power, Amazon's long-awaited fantasy prequel series based on The Lord of the Rings takes place thousands of years earlier in the second age of Middle Earth. September 6, book, The Marriage Portrait. Maggie O'Farrell breathes new life into the story of Lucrezia de' Medici, the noblewoman whose death in 1561 at 16 was rumored to be caused by poisoning at the hand of her husband. September 6, TV, Queen Sugar. The epic saga from Ava DuVernay closes out on OWN with a seventh and final season following the Bordelon family on their rural Louisiana sugarcane farm. September 9, album, Age, Sex, Location. Neo-soul artist Ari Lennox will release the follow-up to her acclaimed intimate 2019 debut, Shea Butter Baby. September 9, TV, American Gigolo. John Bernthal stars in the TV adaptation of the 1980 Richard Gere film of the same name about a sex worker who is framed for murder. September 9, album Legend. John Legend's eighth studio album is a double with a wealth of notable features from Saweetie to Jasmine Sullivan. September 11, TV, Monarch. Susan Sarandon and Trace Adkins lead this Fox drama about one family's multi-generational country music dynasty facing a crossroads. September 13, People Person. Queenie author Candace Carty Williams returns with a big-hearted reminder that a messy family is still a family. September 13, Woman Without Shame. Sandra Cisneros' first book of poetry in 28 years is an electrifying collection of meditations on her life and work as an artist. September 15, TV, Atlanta. In its fourth and final season, Donald Glover's FX comedy drama returns to its roots after a season in Europe in a homecoming of sorts and a fond farewell to the city. interview Mongolia's leader on life between China and Russia. This is by Charlie Campbell, and it may be abridged. In a wood-paneled office, Mongolia's Prime Minister, Luv Sonaramsen Oyun Erdena, sits in front of a gilt-framed painting of a warrior and fawn called Hero Going to War. But the last thing Mongolia needs, sandwiched between Russia and China, is war, or heroics of any kind. We are located geopolitically between two superpowers, says Oyun Erdena, who became prime minister in January 2021 after serving 2 years as chief cabinet secretary. His nation, twice the size of Turkey, has just 3.3 million people. We are very sensitive to global economic fluctuations, he says, which is a blessing and a curse. The blessings are straightforward. Mongolia has the world's biggest coal reserves, second largest reserves of uranium, and one of the largest of silver. Throw in significant deposits of gold, copper, iron ore, phosphorus, and zinc, and it is clear why spiking commodity prices are a boon. The immediate curse, however, is inflation. The price of fuel is soaring. Russian President Vladimir Putin's February 24 invasion of Ukraine and ensuing Western sanctions have also led to spikes in the cost of Russian chemicals used for mining explosives, fertilizer and agricultural feed, and food. That's outside the parenthesis of the chemicals. Tourism has evaporated, and not just from COVID-19. The European embargo of Russian airspace has led to a slashing of flights to Mongolia's capital, Ulaanbaatar. Oyun Erdena laments the effect of instability of the international community. The situation threatens his bid to transform Mongolia from an agricultural economy, a third of the population lives in poverty, into a modern minerals exporter with a startup-friendly environment. Last year, he implemented an ambitious plan, Vision 2050, to increase GDP per capita almost tenfold to $38,359. We have done our homework, and now we have to put these developments into real life, he says. Oyun Erdena was born in Ulaanbaatar in 1980, but grew up in Berk on the eastern Mongolian steppes. He did well academically, earning degrees in journalism, law, and public policy at Harvard Kennedy School. Unlike a prior generation of leaders educated in the former Soviet bloc, at the age of just 21, Oyun Erdena ran the governor's office in Berk. Later, he worked overseas for the NGO World Vision. He was first elected as an MP in 2016. As commodity prices soared in the early 2000s, Mongolia briefly became the world's fastest-growing economy. But the mineral boom was short-lived, and by 2017, Mongolia went to the International Monetary Fund for a $5.5 billion bailout. Today, commodity prices are high again, and Oyun Erdena hopes to capitalize by modernizing Mongolia's economy through infrastructural projects, from hydroelectric dams to power plants. However, Beijing's draconian zero-COVID policy means it sporadically seals a border that Mongolia relies on for 90% of trade, including with other nations that must use Chinese ports. Oyun Erdena expresses concern for the negative consequences this has for his country, adding, "The zero-COVID policy of China is a global economic issue." It is another spur for Mongolia's long-running third neighbor policy of cultivating relationships beyond China and Russia. In recent months, Western nations have expressed kinship with a democratic country in an adversarial region. Germany announced in June it was restarting bilateral aid with Mongolia. From July 1, Mongolians became eligible for Australia's coveted holiday visa program. Broadly speaking, the West is reawakening to values diplomacy, energizing democracy promotion, says Professor Julian Dirks, a Mongolia expert at the University of British Columbia. This is where Mongolia triumphs. Ouyan Erdena has just returned from visits to Singapore, Estonia, and South Korea. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres visited August 8, yet Mongolia abstained from the UN General Assembly motion to condemn Russia's invasion of Ukraine. With regard to the Ukraine and Russia war, we are truly regretful, Ouyan Erdena says, but the foreign policy of Mongolia must remain independent. The bottom line, relations with our two neighbors is the priority. The painted warrior on his office wall may be going to battle, but Ouyan Erdena's fight will be to stay non-aligned. And that was the entire article. We have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.